Come on aboard, I promise you. There's lots of room for you on the bandwagon.
Hey there, it's time for another episode of the Bandwagon Sports Podcast. I'm Brian Moline.
Oh, hey, I'm Lisa Braltz.
John Steinbacher.
Hey there, John Steinbacher. We've got kind of a pre-Thanksgiving episode for you, hoping to have this one up for your holiday drives, wherever you and yours may be gathering for this Thanksgiving holiday. So thanks for tuning in. We've got some fun stuff to talk about here this week. We'll start just talking a little bit about Thanksgiving and sports and see, you know, what the three of us do on Thanksgiving Day, whether it's all football all the time or something else. We'll talk a little bit about college hoops, a little bit of Illini stuff, a lot of news lately for the men's program, and we'll talk a little bit about transfers as well and how those work, specifically in the case of Shatrice White, former Illini basketball player. We'll talk a little bit about last Saturday's Illinois-Iowa football game, which I went to and kind of had ties to both teams, which was kind of weird. We'll talk about that a little bit. Lisa has our rivalry. And we'll have our status updates where we take a look at some social media items that caught our eye here over the last couple of weeks. It's good to be back in here with you guys.
Yeah, it feels like it's been months. It's really only been 2 weeks.
Yeah, only 2 weeks, but it feels like longer, but it's good to be back with you. And let's talk a little bit about our Thanksgiving sports traditions. For me, I think wherever I go on Thanksgiving, it's pretty standard. Football tends to be on. Mostly NFL football. Then as the night moves on, maybe a college game will get turned on here or there, depending on who's playing. But that tends to be about it. It's pretty much football from the time the first game starts, I think at 11 a.m. Central Time, all the way through whenever the last one's over.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, now they have Thursday night games. The games are always really, they're never very exciting.
Well, the Lions are always playing on Thanksgiving, so what do you expect? Although, it's funny, this year, it's actually a battle for first place with the Lions and Vikings. Who saw that one coming?
Not me. Not a lot of people pick the Vikings, I guess. I don't know.
Not the Lions. Nobody ever picks the Lions.
I just think it's interesting because we've talked about the NFL and its popularity maybe slightly waning this year and stuff. And we used to, when I would go to my father's for Thanksgiving, we would watch the NFL all day. And now I host Thanksgiving and We don't watch the NFL usually. Maybe I can get it on occasionally, but I don't really care.
Yeah.
Illinois plays at 2:00, which is unfortunate because we would definitely watch the Illinois game, but I think it's going to roll out right around the time that people will be eating. So that
which is what time for you guys? What time do you eat?
I don't know. About 2:00, 2:30.
Now, if I'm at my family's in Iowa, if I'm at my mom's grandma's for Thanksgiving, they eat early. It's like noon. They eat really early for Thanksgiving.
But they're getting in two services. Then you're going to have like a 5 or 6 o'clock.
Yeah, then you have the second leftover serving. Yeah, that always is helpful. And then when I go to my in-laws where we get together, it's a later thing. It's like 3 or 4 in the afternoon usually.
The noon thing, this is not sports related, but I'm going to just say that the noon thing has always like perplexed me because how early do you have to get up to get everything ready?
Early.
Oh, dark 30. Like, even eating at 5 at my in-laws or at friends, like we've done for the past few years, I felt like I was getting up at 6 and could barely and this wasn't even involving me dealing with the turkey. Mm-hmm. So props to whoever makes sure that everybody eats at noon. Because
you're getting the turkey in the oven at what?
Well, it depends on how big it is. But,
sure.
You know, you could be getting, if you're going to eat at noon, you're getting it in there by 6.
Yeah. Yeah.
Minimum, I would say. Depends, again, on the size of the turkey. But whatever. I don't want to derail it, but I'm always interested in what time people eat.
Watch the parade.
Oh, yeah, the parade.
Yeah, I usually don't watch the parade. I did when I was a kid.
Yeah, I loved it when I was a kid.
I didn't have kids, so.
Yeah, there you go. You got to see Snoopy and
right.
everybody.
And now I watch the parade, now I'm like, it's just a giant balloon.
It is so many giant balloons. Here's my question. So in my family, like, you guys growing up, football was kind of on all day, but the TV was never on while we ate, ever. It didn't matter who was playing. My mother insisted that we eat Thanksgiving without the television on. My recollection is we It was usually just the four of us, my parents, my brother, and me. What about at where you go? Is there a TV on while you're eating the meal?
When I was young, we would go to my great-grandmother's house, and no, the TV was never on during Thanksgiving dinner there. But as I got older, the festivities shifted to my grandma and grandpa's house. I'm trying to remember. I don't think it was usually on during the meal, but just about every other time it was on.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Yeah, I feel like it's never on during the meal, but definitely during dessert. And I feel like maybe occasionally back in the day I went to my aunt's house and they didn't have like a formal table. Mm-hmm. Maybe they just didn't have room for it. So in that case, you just grab some and half the people end up sitting in front of the TV.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's bad either way. It's just something, you know, my mother was pretty militantly against it. And the meals in recent history that I've had at Thanksgiving where the TV has been on have seemed like my kids didn't know what to do.
Right.
Like, do we sit at the table with you or do we go sit in front of the Dallas Cowboys?
I will say that now that we host Thanksgiving dinner, my sister-in-law and my spouse sort of run the show and there will not be any TV on anywhere near.
They roll with an iron fist, do they?
Yeah, yeah.
One other thing I wanted to point out is that I think with so many other options of sports to view and how to view them, that football doesn't have to be that choice. You can put on a replay of a soccer game or any other thing, which I could see us doing.
There's a lot of NCAA basketball. And then,
yes.
And then interestingly, one thing that I used to do all the time with my dad was on Friday watch, I think usually Texas A&M plays on Friday. We watch that. Okay, a lot of college football this weekend. A lot of big college football games, but
yes.
I probably won't do any of that because got to go see movies with the kids and get a Christmas tree. Oh, my goodness.
Wait, you're doing that already?
Yeah, I mean, I'm going to invest in a Christmas tree. I want it to, you know, I want to get my money's worth.
So you're getting the real tree, the actual live Christmas tree.
Yeah.
You're a brave man, Steinbacher.
Go out to that place way out in Urbana.
The tree cutting place?
I guess.
Yeah. Huh.
I would like to endorse them, but I don't remember what their name is. Anyway.
That's quite all right. So that's kind of our Thanksgiving traditions here on the bandwagon and as far as sports go.
I want to remind people who are listening, go ahead and share them with us.
Yeah,
you know, are
do.
You pro watching football while you're eating your turkey or your – it's almost always turkey, right? It's ham at Christmas if you're going to do ham. You know, let us know. Tweet at us and let us know what you guys do. What is the tradition in your family, whether it involves sports or not? We don't care. Just tell us.
Yeah, I'm curious. I'd be curious, you know, what the traditions are maybe outside of football. Since I think football is kind of the one that everybody's used to.
I would say this. If Illinois basketball was a little better this year and on a nice trajectory, I might fight a little bit, not necessarily to watch the game during Thanksgiving dinner, but to maybe push dinner back until the game was over. But
that's a whole other topic of discussion. It's like moving things around sports.
Yeah. But and this will transition nicely into our next topic. After last night, maybe Illinois will make the tournament, but they're not going very far.
That was a
make which kind of tournament?
Well, they better make the real tournament.
Yeah, the NCAA tournament for job security for
guys,
coaches.
I don't know.
So
I don't. After last night, I just don't know.
Well, they lost at home last night to Winthrop. If anyone was not paying attention to that, Illinois 4-1 on the season, and you know, they'd been kind of uneven in their first four games. So I guess it shouldn't necessarily be a shocker that they lost a game to.
I think the way they lost is really the.
Yeah, they were up by 10 points with about 3 minutes to go and blew the lead. It went into overtime and Winthrop won in overtime. They had this guard, Keon Johnson, who just went absolutely nuts. 38 points, I think it was.
Mm-hmm.
And Winthrop likely to possibly make the NCAA 60 field of 64 tournament. But that's because they are in a conference that probably isn't that great.
A one-bid league.
So it's not, you know, it's not like they lost to someone who is basically barely a Division I team, but still should have won that game.
Yeah, especially at home, got to win that game. And that's just the latest bit of Illini basketball news here in the last week. With recruiting, there was kind of a bit of a saga related to a five-star recruit named Jeremiah Tillman out of Belleville, Illinois, who had verbally committed, to Illinois, but then when the signing period started last week, he did not sign his letter of intent immediately, kind of making Illini fans
very nervous. They freaked out.
There was much angst on social media from
for good reason, because there's been a lot of terrible things that have happened to especially,
we've been played before.
Yes, several times.
Yes.
And particularly the nerves here were because the rumors were Kansas. Mm. Who was interested in also SLU with Travis Ford, who recently picked off, I forget what his name is. See, this is how it works.
Yeah, another.
He's dead to me now.
Yeah, another recruit from Belleville, I believe.
Well, from the area.
Was it Jordan Goodwin?
Yeah.
His name?
Yep. And okay. He was supposed to be the final piece of the recruiting puzzle and left at the last minute. So there was a good reason to worry, and good for John Gross for. You know, they haven't said anything. It's all personal reasons or something, but the speculation is that Tillman had second thoughts.
Yeah, yeah. So Tillman did sign his letter of intent on the last day to do so, had a press conference the next day announcing such, so John Gross finally gets his player.
For those in the audience who maybe do not follow these kinds of things closely, what kind of commitment does a letter of intent, what does it mean?
Basically, it means that if you play college basketball next season, you will play for this team.
Is it legally binding?
I mean, in the NCAA verse, yes.
Okay.
It is, yes, binding by the NCAA.
I mean, he could go play in China or something like that. You know, I mean, he could go play pro somewhere else. He couldn't play in the NBA just because the NBA's rules. But.
And should there be some kind of a coaching change or something at Illinois, he could petition the NCAA to allow him to go elsewhere, but the NCAA would have to approve that.
And, Illinois could let him out of it for whatever reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Not that they'd want to, but.
Right. So,
okay. All right.
So, yeah, that's the whole saga of Jeremiah Tillman. And something else that John noticed here a couple weeks ago.
I was at a local establishment, the Black Dog in Urbana, watching, getting ready to go to, I forget what I was doing, but. We were sitting at the bar, and I just noticed the Florida State University of Connecticut women's basketball game was on. And I was shocked because Shatrice White, former Illinois player who transferred last year, is playing. And the basic rule in the NCAA is when you transfer, unless you have like a really good reason, you need to sit out a season, and we can get into this because that's the whole thing is for why. I mean, who knows? I guess it's punishment for wanting to change your ways. I don't know what the official reason is.
Which team is she playing for?
She plays for Florida State.
Okay.
So I sort of went down the rabbit hole here. And, you know, part of it is, to be perfectly honest, women's basketball probably doesn't get as much coverage as men's basketball. So it was sort of harder to find information. She basically petitioned to have her transfer sit out year waived, and it was waived, but I can't find any – there's no, like, reason given, and I don't – this is what makes transferring in the NCAA very mysterious and whatever. There's no clear cut, this is why we will waive it or not. Supposedly, it's supposed to be for personal reasons such as, you know, you're transferring because you're – parent or a close family member is ill or something like that, and then they'll waive it. But there was no clear reason given for Shatrice White. Some speculation being that, maybe people aren't familiar with, the University of Illinois women's basketball team had some major issues about a year or two ago where a lot of players alleged that there was some severe racial preferences going on with Matt Bolant and an assistant coach, I don't remember his name.
Mike DeVilbiss.
Mike DeVilbiss has left the program, and at that point a lot of players transferred away. And because of the situation, when they transferred, they were allowed to waive the year of sitting out. But Shatrice White her and her family were staunch defenders of Bolant. And so I don't know. Perhaps the reason was that I can't remember his name.
DeVilbiss.
Perhaps because he was the one who recruited her and he left, they granted her a waiver. I'm not sure. There's no information on that. I went down the rabbit hole of message boards and there's lots of speculation. apparently Florida State a year or two before this had a recruit transfer in, Leticia Romero, who also got her transfer year waived. So there's a lot of speculation that maybe Florida State knows something that others don't. The other interesting thing is another Illini, Brooke Kissinger, transferred out last year. She's going to Creighton, but she will be sitting out this year. So, this is just basically saying how crazy these transfer rules are, and it's basically become its own industry. There's all this talk about how crazy it is. You know, some coaches believe there's too many transfers. A lot of the sports world believes that this sitting out a year is a bunch of crap. You know, the argument goes a coach can leave anytime they want and go make millions of dollars, but a student can't, has to sit out a year. And in like the SEC and stuff, they have rules about you can't transfer to other schools or you have to sit out and, and the Big Ten, Bo Ryan a couple years ago famously had a list that, what was his name,
Jared Utoff, he was originally from Iowa, and he committed to play at Wisconsin. He went to Wisconsin and sat out a year. He redshirted. And after his redshirt year, he decided he wanted to transfer back to Iowa. And Bo Ryan basically would not sign off on the transfer because it was to another Big Ten school. Essentially what happened was that, you know, Utoff was able to then to eventually transfer, but he had to sit out another year. So he ended up losing a year of eligibility in the process of that whole deal. So
that was a year of eligibility even.
Right.
That's
right.
Crazy.
It wasn't just another redshirt season. He lost that year. He didn't get it back later on.
So I want to circle back just for a second about how this can become its own like little college industry within sports. Like, are there actual brokers or people working, or are you talking about it from a journalistic standpoint, or is it?
What do you mean?
You had said, you know, like this has become its own industry within college
sports. Oh, like, I meant like the media. It's a talking point for the media.
Sure.
There's the rules. If you Google it, there's a bunch of NCAA actual official materials about transfer rules and stuff like that. In a lot of cases, we're not talking about NBA caliber prospects. We're talking about people. I think in most cases, what will happen is someone goes to a school and is not playing as much as they wanted to, so they decide to transfer out, or they don't like the coach. So I don't think there's a lot of behind the scenes like money men. Like, you know, obviously when you're talking about potential NBA draft prospects, there's a whole real industry behind them, who are seeing dollar bills and trying to
sure.
But I don't think that's what's happening here. I can't think of a transfer that actually probably made it to the NBA. But it is a way for example, the University of Illinois, John Gross has done this a lot. He's got a lot of transfers right now. Someone on the bench, Kipper Nichols, basically transferred mid-year. One of the things that he has done a lot of is it's called the fifth-year transfer, which you don't have to sit out because theoretically, if you graduate from a program and then you want to go to grad school, and I'm saying that in air quotes because in most cases they just want to play another year of basketball, and your current school doesn't offer that grad program that you want to go into, you can transfer to a different school to play your fifth year anywhere you want, and you don't have to sit out a year. There's been a lot of Illinois players over the last
four years
have done that. Russell Wilson, who's plays for the Seattle Seahawks, famously did that and transferred to University of Wisconsin, had a great season there and really increased his draft stock. So there's an example of someone transferring and really doing well for themselves.
Yeah, that fifth-year transfer rule is, you know, one that's controversial. What ends up happening a lot of times is you have players who were really good for the so-called mid-major schools, you know, teams that are, you know, maybe just below that, you know, Power 5 conference level. They want a chance to play for a bigger school. So they if they've sat out a year already, you know, they graduate from their mid-major school, they can go to the big school for their final year, you know, and you know, the smaller schools are unhappy about it because they lose some of their best players in this process. You know, the bigger schools are like, hey, come on in. We'll take you. We can use you to, you know, to to make our team better.
And in a lot of cases, the way that college works is the smaller schools are less likely to have graduate programs whereas the bigger schools are. So of course, it works in that way.
It's like I'm listening to this, and it's sort of like a guy like, we'll just use John Gross as an example. Like, I have to think he does not spend all of his time trying to game the system or figure this stuff out. So it's like a B-level strategy sort of thing that's happening underneath everything that you're seeing happening out on the court. It's like all of these machinations are probably being carried out by other coaches. And he's just sort of like weighing in here and there, like whatever.
Yeah, it's
basketball operations. It's, you know, it's the operations side.
It's tricky trying to make contact with these players as well.
Right.
Because, you know, they're technically on scholarship in another school. So a lot of times what will happen is, well, you know, this player's high school coach or AAU coach. So you get in touch with that coach and say, hey, would so-and-so be interested in maybe looking elsewhere for his final year? And you know, it gets a little murky, to say.
And I would say that John Gross has done this a lot, and in most cases it hasn't really turned out that great. I think it's, especially in college basketball, it's pretty hard to have someone come in just for a year, especially since at this point they're not usually, like, the greatest players. I think Sam Maniscalco is probably the one that turned out the best for them, but still wasn't that great. Yeah.
It just sounds to me like further professionalizing of college sports. I mean, that's
right.
You know, I think when you keep saying transfer, it brings me to like big league soccer, because there's transfer windows. It's more like trading, but they use the word transfer. But then they can loan players too, where they can sort of like what you're talking about, maybe get more experience at a different club. So it's almost like a combo of minor league. I don't know. It's very complicated.
It's very complicated, crazy. And I think the biggest complaint is it's not clear. This Satrice White example is the perfect example. They approved her transfer, but it's not like they had to say why, right? Mm-hmm. So it's all happening behind closed doors. They say there's no exact formula, you know. So I imagine if I'm a rival of Florida State, mm-hmm. I'm like, you know, what's going on here? Mm-hmm. It's not exactly, you know, it doesn't seem like it's necessarily on the up and up. They need clear rules if they're going to do this. And, you know, my personal opinion is if college students want to transfer schools, they're allowed to do that, and they should be able to play the next year. You know, if I was going to the University of Illinois as a student and then 2 years in decided I didn't want to be here and I wanted to go somewhere else, I'm allowed to do that. I don't have to, like, sit out of classes a year or something. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Right. Yeah, it is pretty ridiculous. So to quote one of my favorite movie characters, the dude, it's a complicated situation, a lot of ins, a lot of outs, a lot of what-have-yous.
Definitely a lot of what-have-yous.
Many what-have-yous, it sounds like.
So anyway, that's a little look into the murky world of college transfers. Well, let's go back to the gridiron here a little bit. Illinois and Iowa played on Saturday, and it's all ever since I've lived here, really, it's been kind of a whenever those two teams meet, it's been one that, where there's some mixed emotions, because I grew up in Iowa rooting for the Hawkeyes my entire life, and then moved here, where being an Iowa fan is not exactly a real popular thing. And for the first several years, I really kept my staunch Iowa fandom. But as I started doing more on-air work with the University of Illinois, it's one of those things where that fandom kind of waned. I wasn't following Iowa stuff as much. So I started wanting to see Illinois do well in most cases. As it happens, I have a second cousin who's on the Iowa football team now. He's a wide receiver. Jay Shield is his name. He's been a part-time starter this year. Right now he's second team. Got in for about 15 plays or so against Illinois on Saturday. So, you know, not a huge part of the team yet, but he's just a sophomore, so he could, get more and more playing time over the next couple of years. But I went to the game with my wife and with a couple of other family members, Jay's mom and Jay's brother. And we were sitting with the other Iowa fans in, like, the absolute worst section of Memorial Stadium, upper deck east balcony, in the south end zone, right the south end zone. And the wind, of course, was gusting 40 miles an hour out of the northwest.
Well, how was the attendance there?
Bad.
Was it?
It was very bad.
Just don't sugarcoat it.
No,
just, it was bad. Okay.
I don't know what the announced attendance was, but that place was not even half full.
Yeah.
Oh, man. Well, the weather had to be a major
Weather was a factor there for sure. So anyway, it was just kind of a strange experience for me going to a game like that because, I mean, what did I want to see? Well, I wanted to see my cousin do well. You know, he got in for about 15 plays but never had a pass thrown his way. There wasn't a lot of passing in the game just because of the conditions. So I wanted to see him do well. And beyond that, I guess going in, I was kind of just rooting for a competitive game. It was close. It was 7-0 at halftime.
Yeah. Up to a point, it was close.
And it was 14-0 after three quarters, so still not out of the realm of possibility. But then, you know, Iowa added a couple touchdowns late. So I guess if it was just a weird game wherein I really didn't have a big rooting interest as far as who won. It was just kind of strange for me. Sitting there, I really wasn't cheering plays much for either side, just kind of watching everything unfold. It was almost like it was happening somewhere else. It was just kind of weird.
But you have, like, different reasons for feeling some distance or, like, kind of above it all, I think. Like, you know, you grew up maybe rooting for one team or being of a place. I think if our team were doing better or were more dominant, maybe you'd be more caught up in the excitement, or maybe not. Maybe your warring loyalties would sort of neutralize each other, and it sounds like that's kind of where you were. But there were so many extenuating factors, like Illinois' football team is not very good, the weather was terrible, like, you know, you were with people from the other place.
Yeah.
So yeah, I don't know. It's interesting.
Yeah, it was just kind of weird watching it. And as the game went on, you know, I think if I was rooting for anything as the game went on, I just kind of kept rooting for Illinois to score to make it
more interesting.
More competitive game for a couple of reasons. One, it would have been more fun to watch. And two, if it was a closer game, Iowa might have thrown the ball more. And
my cousin
might have been able to catch a pass or something. But yeah, it was just kind of an odd experience. Although, and the second half was much better, if not from a competitive standpoint, from a seat standpoint. Some of the people I was sitting with, they had a friend that was sitting across in the west side in, like, section 126, about 20 rows up, and, like, there was nobody else in their row. So they said, hey, come on over at halftime. So we did, and it was a lot less windy in that location in the second half.
It's interesting. When you said you were going to talk about this, I tried to think of something similar, and I can't. I went down, like, all of my sports fandoms, and there's a clear, you know, I would say my second favorite baseball team is the Twins, but, like, if they played the Cubs, it wouldn't even be close. Maybe in hockey, which I'm not really that interested in, at this point, I'd rather see the Maple Leafs win than the Blackhawks, but I'm not a huge fan of hockey anyway. So yeah, I don't really know. Like, I can't think of anything. I mean, when I'm watching sports where I don't have any interest, my rooting interest is usually, like you said, for, like, a close game.
Yeah,
like, just to make it interesting. But yeah, I can't think of any sort of thing where I mean, I went to the University of Minnesota, but I could care less about their sports totally.
You're not a big Goldie Gopher fan.
I mean, I guess I went there for graduate school, but I went here for undergrad. But yeah, who cares about the Goldie?
Well, on that note, so every year for the last, like, 3 or 4 years, my brother has gotten us all tickets to go watch University of Illinois men's basketball play University of Minnesota men's basketball here, whenever that game is here. And I have similar feelings to Brian, I think. It's like, oh, Minnesota, yay. Love Minnesota. I'm from Minnesota. My daughter goes to school in Minnesota, though not at the University of Minnesota. Basketball team hasn't been that great. Again, so, like, for me, it definitely is this feeling of detachment while I'm watching. I don't really care about the University of Minnesota basketball team. I think my brother, for whatever reason, still feels like super Minnesota fandom, probably because he hasn't lived here for almost 21 years like I have. Yeah. So, but I don't feel any sort of supreme loyalty to the basketball team either. It's just sort of this sort of, like, neutral space, like, that Brian was talking about. However, in my house, we do have something called a meteor game, where we hate both teams. And we just kind of, we don't want either team to win. So a meteor would be a great deciding factor.
I'm curious. What would be a a meteor soccer matchup in your house?
That's a good question. Well, so if we're talking EPL, mm-hmm. everybody pretty much hates Chelsea in mm-hmm. my house.
Okay.
But I can't think of another team that everybody hates. It's just okay. they always want Chelsea to lose, especially if they're playing like Arsenal mm-hmm. Or Liverpool. That's kind of the big household favorite right now. But other than that, I can't think of an EPL team where we really want, you know, Champions League. I don't know. We just love certain teams and don't think too much about the teams that we hate. In college basketball, though, like North Carolina, Duke is always a meteor game for us. It's like, ugh, who cares? Really? Yeah. We have to watch this?
Especially
or
now
Duke, Kansas? Please.
Now that North Carolina has Roy Williams. I always look kind of like Dean Smith, but that's a long time ago.
That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
I have a question. Mm-hmm. You guys are talking about how long you've lived here. Are you guys townies now, or can you never be a townie unless you were born here?
In my perspective, I think Lisa's a townie.
Okay,
she's been here longer than I have, and I think Lisa definitely qualifies.
Now,
I've been here 16 years.
That's only 5 years.
Yeah, but I don't know what it is. I think you know Lisa's done lots of cool stuff around here, and
I also have kids in the community there. And Lily was born here. Cody came here when he was 3, and so, and Jim lived here before. So we had ties to the community even before we came here. Although that's weird. No one's ever called me a townie, like called me, and I don't take it as a pejorative. But this is by far the longest I've ever lived anywhere.
Yeah, I have not yet exceeded my time in Iowa. I lived in Iowa, of course, for 18 years before I graduated high school. 16 here, so that day is soon coming. I don't know. I don't know if I qualify yet. I don't quite feel like a townie yet, but I think I'm getting
But you've
close.
Been on the radio. You say that I've done lots of stuff in the community. Whatever. You've been on the – but you were like – you have been a fixture on the airwaves in this community for a long time. I think people would be surprised to know that you're actual – I mean, some people may be hearing for the first time that you are not of this place.
Perhaps.
You know?
Perhaps.
So it could come as a surprise. It's a good question, John.
It is. So we'll leave that as an open question. You could feel free to chime in.
Please, chime in.
Am I a townie? Is Lisa a townie? We know Steinbacher is.
How do you get townie
status? I'm definitely
status?
Not a townie.
What does that mean?
You're not a townie?
I'm not from here.
Really?
I'm from Bourbonnais.
So you're a Central Illinois denizen.
Yeah.
Oh, that's right. So you haven't been living here that long. You were here in college, but then...
But you're friends with townies.
5 + 8, 13.
Oh, really?
I lived in Bourbonnais until I was 18, so I got a ways ago.
All right.
Plus, I left it for Canada, so that, like, that negates a lot. That's like 2 years in Canada is worth like 12 here, so...
Okay. Oh,
so they have a years thing like dogs?
I'm just saying, like, oh, you lived in Canada? You're not a townie.
Right. You're barely an American.
Yeah. All right, so we'll see who qualifies as a townie, if any of us do. Feel free to chime in on Twitter at us about that topic if you'd like. All right, it is rivalry time, and the one, the only, Lisa Brault has that for us this week.
Yes, so... So my rivalry has to do with a sport or an activity, I guess. Ooh. I think it's a sport. With the following terminology, you can guess. Left-hander, so that could be just about anything. Yeah. Goofy footer, left barrel, and getting shacked.
No idea.
No, I got nothing.
Surfing.
Oh.
Surfing, guys. And I'm talking like world-class... Crazy pants, surfing. And the reason I came upon this rivalry is because a few weeks ago we were doing some work on our house and our friend Tim Gibbs came over. And he is a surfer. He is I wouldn't call him a townie. He hasn't lived here. He's lived here about as long as me. I think we got here at about the same time-ish. And he is a surfer. He was actually training for the Olympics and skiing at one point. He's from the East Coast and... got into surfing. And so when I say that he's into surfing, he travels now with his family. Before it was just him, to places like Tahiti, Hawaii, Fiji, to chase waves.
Man, I should get into surfing.
I know, right? So he's been at it for a while, and he was over at our house, and he's like, "You guys should download the World Surf League app for your over the top device." Uh-huh. So we did, and I think there was some sort of event going on, and I was mesmerized by the footage. It's not just people surfing; they also have these like drone shots of the waves coming in wherever they are, and I learned a lot about surfing in this time about There are three main event types of surfing, and some people are really good at one. Some people are really good at all of them. So anyway, the rivalry I'm going to talk about, and I'll be fairly brief just because I could go on forever about it, is between the surfer Kelly Slater and the surfer Andy Irons. Have you guys heard of either of these people?
Kelly Slater, I've heard of.
Kelly Slater is like, you know, like probably the most famous surfer there's been.
Tony Hawk of surfing.
He is very much the Tony Hawk of surfing. And so by the time this rivalry was getting going, sort of in the very early 2000s, Kelly Slater had already won several world championships. Andy Irons was coming on, was a much younger guy, 6 years between them at least. So that's not much, but that's enough. I mean, you know, if somebody coming up behind you is like 20 and you're 26, 27 years old, that can be a big difference. And people had been accusing Kelly Slater of becoming complacent. He had retired. And then this guy comes up and who's just like sort of giving him a hard time and call him an old man or whatever. Mm-hmm. And he's like, and what Andy Irons didn't really know about Kelly Slater is that the boredom was coming from not being challenged. And we've talked about this in terms of head-to-head rivalries, like person-to-person. I'm thinking specifically of Bjorn Borg and John McEnroe, where you almost needed that other person to up your game, right? So Kelly Slater took this as a sort of a gauntlet being thrown down, and they basically dueled back and forth for like 5 years in the mid-2000s. And it really brought, and it was sort of like punk rock. They were kind of punk rock about it. Like they would actively work to get into each other's heads. I remember reading, and I have many, many links and videos and things to post for you guys on our webpage. But this one instance that keeps happening is during one of the world surf tournaments. They were like going head to head. It was the final. And Kelly Slater goes up to Andy Irons, puts his arm around him and whispers in his ear, "I love you, man." And then Andy Irons beat him. Like it was they were just constantly trying to, you know, unnerve each other. The sad postscript to this is that Andy Irons passed away in 2010. And so that rivalry sort of had come to its natural close, but then Andy Irons was sick and passed away in a hotel room outside of Dallas after pulling out of a surfing tournament. So they were still competing against each other even back then. So it's fascinating, I know. And also, once you start watching these surfing videos, you're kind of like, how does this even work? How can they? Some of the stuff I was seeing was incredible. By the way, getting shacked sounds terrible, but actually it's being completely enveloped in a wave, but like in the air space of it. It's like being in that pocket. And just watching videos of these guys, you know, they're not hitting balls against each other or hitting each other or anything. They're both doing their thing against each other. It's fascinating. So I will post lots of links and get you guys hooked on watching surfing.
Yeah. Look forward to seeing that. Should be fun.
Yeah.
That's our rivalry for this week, and now it's time to close things out with our status updates, what caught our eyes on social media. How about we start with you, John Steinbacher?
All right, well, so I don't want to jump into the philosophy of what exactly I'm supposed to do during this segment, but this is something that was like national news and on things, but I saw it on social media, so does that count, I guess? It's just an interesting sports thing that happened recently.
Yeah. Okay. That's good enough.
Yeah, I mean, that
all right, well,
we have a pretty broad definition here, I'd say.
The other day, Michigan State was playing Florida Gulf Coast, and it was a close game at home. Michigan State winning by 1 point with 1.6 seconds left. The Florida Gulf Coast throws the ball in, and you're not supposed to – the timer isn't supposed to start until someone on Florida Gulf Coast touches the ball, but he started it right away, blah, blah, blah. Long story short, the timer was way off. The guy took a quick shot, missed it. Big controversy. Clearly the wrong call, but afterwards everyone – blah, blah, blah. What I found was interesting was – Michigan State has a history of having poor clock management. I don't know if you know about this. We probably do. And there was a game, Michigan football, Michigan versus Michigan State, where the infamous Spartan Bob would not let the clock wind down and gave Michigan State an extra second in which they scored a touchdown anyway. Apparently, Michigan State has a bunch of home – I mean, this is a topic that I think is just interesting to talk about is – the whole idea of whoever's running the clock is obviously from that place, right?
Well, ironically, in the case you're talking about, it was an official who had a gadget on him who started the clock.
Oh, really?
That's what the Michigan State game? Yeah, from that Michigan State Florida Gulf Coast game, that's what was announced anyway by the officiating overseers.
But I don't understand. In that case where they're clearly, you go back right away, you can clearly see there was a huge mistake made, and it's just like, too bad.
Yeah, that's what I don't get is why it wasn't, why they didn't.
You just replay it.
Yeah,
right?
Start from that play. Yeah. Let them inbound the ball again with 1.6 to go. Yeah, I don't understand why they didn't do that.
Anyway, fun stuff.
Good times. I'll go next.
Okay.
This just popped up this morning from the good folks at Awful Announcing, a very fun Twitter follow, by the way, if you're not familiar
with it. Awful Announcing?
Awful Announcing.
I'm going to find it.
So if you're thinking about, you know, a member of the NBA champion Cleveland Cavaliers who might have a movie made about him, you'd think, okay, LeBron James might be an obvious choice. Maybe J.R. Smith. He's a colorful character, always taking his shirt off for no good reason. Maybe even somebody like Kyrie Irving. Kevin Love, maybe. Yeah, it might be a bit of a stretch.
Well, I mean, it would be an interesting movie, but it wouldn't be, you know, super uplifting.
Yeah. I don't think the guy you'd have on your list is Matthew Dellavedova. But apparently, he is a big deal in Australia because that's where he's from. And so Dellavedova's agent has set his client's story up with a couple of producers in Los Angeles to develop a feature film about his life and professional basketball career. The producers envision Dellavedova's story as a feel-good sports movie along the lines of Hoosiers and Rocky.
Wow.
Yeah.
Is there a scene early on where he's inspired by watching Luke Longley? The only other Australian basketball player I can think of right now.
Yeah, there have been a few others, but yeah, Luke Longley is
it's a name I haven't heard for a long time.
Yeah, so look for Matthew Dellavedova's story on a screen near you, or at least in Australia sometime in the next few years.
Wow.
Sweet.
Yeah. All right, Lisa, what you got?
So mine is also very recent, i.e. this morning. I received the word last night via my husband, Jim, soccer coach, that Jurgen Klinsmann, who was the head coach of the U.S. men's national team, was sacked, as they would say, overseas. In fact, on Reddit, they were very upset last night that somebody had used the word fired in the...
Oh, yeah. Like, you're talking soccer. He's sacked.
They're like...
Well, they're calling it soccer, so from that point,
well,
already...
Well, they're like, we had no idea that our soccer was so full of Americans. And there was that conversation devolved very quickly. But what I love... So my friend Bruce McGuire, who goes by the name Du Nord and is a big Minnesota United supporter... and I've known Bruce for a really long time, on Facebook this morning was just like, Jurgen Klinsmann's gone, and a bunch of his friends chime in, and one of his friends said, Ted Lasso. I vote for Ted Lasso. Now, for those who don't know, Ted Lasso is a fictitious character, a soccer coach, an American football coach who gets a few years ago. Oh, they did a whole series
of spoof
ads,
commercials,
commercials, where he goes I can't remember which team he's coaching, and I'll post links to the videos.
It's like Everton or somebody.
It's Everton or Tottenham Hotspur or somebody like that, and then he gets sacked. And then moves on to Leicester.
Wasn't it Jason Sudeikis who played him?
Yes, that's right. So, and then my husband found a screen grab or made a screen grab or maybe just found a shot of Ted Lasso, Coach Lasso, sitting by his framed jersey that his team had gotten him with the last name Wanker. And just posted that picture. And that was probably my favorite thing because I am a huge, huge Ted Lasso fan. The commercials, the ads are great. You know, they're basically advertisements for NBC's soccer coverage, which is kind of was a new thing at the time. And there are at least three or four really good spots. And Jason today, I mean, he's fabulous. So anyway, so maybe we'll get Ted Lasso as a U.S. men's national team. Coach, it has to be better.
Well, in the meantime, Bruce Arena
over. Yeah, I know. Which I thought of all the coaching talent out there, you know, and I think the problems with the U.S. men's national team have been like tactical sort of issues, but also locker room issues. Landon Donovan's come back and I don't think he's on the team, but there was like a big conflict between Klinsmann and Donovan. And, you know, get somebody who's going to inspire you. Why are you going back? And maybe this is a placeholder.
Yeah,
I think it's a placeholder
through the next
I don't
World
know.
Cup? Come on, Brian.
I don't know. I just saw that he's named interim.
Yeah, so. No, he is. And I don't know what that's going to mean. And our team is not – when you look at us in the scope of, like, the world, we're not that great. We've got a few really good players. This young player, Christian Pusilic, I think is how you say his last name. He plays for Dortmund over in Germany. He's fantastic. And he's, like, head and shoulders above almost everybody else there. We need some more young folks like him. He's only 18 years old. So, anyway, that's my social media update.
Klinsmann sacked.
Sacked.
All right. Well, that will wrap it up for this episode. So, the one, the only Lisa Braltz has our closing credits.
Yes. Thank you, as we love having you guys along for the ride here on the bandwagon. Extra thanks. I want to give extra thanks to Tim Gibbs for providing my rivalry inspiration and getting me hooked. Like, I ask now, can we put on the Surfing Channel? I ask for that at home. So anyway, we love you guys. Today's bandwagon podcast was produced by Brian Moline, me, Lisa Braltz, and John Steinbacher. Once again here, 2 weeks in a row, he's been here. He also actually did a lot of the legwork in putting this episode to, like, you know, he and Brian met. I was out of the office, so thanks, guys, for carrying on without me.
It was all Steinbacher.
There are other people who have helped Bandwagon become this entity. Scott Cameron, Jim Kelly, Mike Bowman, Taylor Judd, and, of course, REM. You can find us on the web at will.illinois.edu/bandwagon, where you'll find links and show notes, videos like the Ted Lasso videos I'm talking about, and some surfing videos. You can also subscribe to our podcast and rate it in iTunes. Rating really helps people find us, so if you have a few minutes or a couple seconds or whatever, please rate us. You can follow us on Twitter at Bandwagon Podcast, all consonants, no vowels. And get our recent thoughts on stuff. Let us know what your Thanksgiving sports watching traditions are. Is Brian Italian or not? Let us know. We also all have our own Twitter accounts, and you can follow each of us if you want to. In the meantime, we'll be back soon with a brand new episode. But until then, have a great holiday.